is number 063529, Brown against Family Dollar Store. Mr. Weldy.
Good morning, Your Honors. If it pleases the Court, Attorney Ronald E. Weldy on behalf of the appellant, Vivian Brown. There are three issues pending today in front of this Court. The first two have to do with the opinion of Judge McKinney granting the summary judgment motion of Family Dollar. The first and foremost is an issue of first impression for this Court, and that has to do with what is the proper standard of review on a summary judgment motion regarding an FLSA case. The second issue was the finding of Judge McKinney that Ms. Brown did not challenge the accuracy of Family Dollar's timekeeping records on summary judgment. And then the third issue has to do with employer's argument, and there's a section in our brief titled Brown's Affidavit and Supplemental Interrogatory Response Should Be Stricken. And, Your Honors, just because it's a fairly short and small issue, I'll address that one first. We had filed a motion to strike, which fortuitously, a week later, I happened to be reading an article in Indiana Lawyer saying that that was a really bad idea, so we withdrew that argument and feeling that it had been adequately briefed in our reply brief. And the basis of the argument that the this particular section of the employer's brief should not be considered by this Court is the fact that the district court denied the motion to strike filed below by Family Dollar, and they did that simultaneously with their ruling on the motion for summary judgment. The Family Dollar did not appeal this decision or file a cross motion, or I should say a cross appeal, pursuant to Appellate Rule 4A3. As such, under the court's case of, and I may pronounce this incorrectly, Chawanayak v. Arlington Park Racetrack, this court cannot grant any relief to Family Dollar with regard to their request that this court not consider the supplemental interrogatory response of Ms. Brown or her affidavit. And that's pretty much all we have to say on that issue. With regard to what the proper standard of review on a motion for summary judgment should be in an FLSA case, we want to make this court aware of a case that also came down in the Southern District of Indiana literally 2 days after we had filed our reply brief. Specifically, that case was decided by Judge Tinder on June 1st, 2007, and the name of the case was Shelton versus Family Dollar.
Have you advised opposing counsel of the case?
Actually, opposing counsel and I were exactly the same attorneys on that case, Your Honor.
See. Thank you.
And just for the court's reference, the cause number of that case is 1:05CV756. In that case, we had identical arguments made by the plaintiffs, which were represented by me. There were actually three separate employees, and identical arguments made by the employer. And there was the contention that the plaintiffs must come forward with definite and certain evidence. Judge Tinder, in his ruling, stated, and I quote, "This places too heavy a burden on the plaintiff." Judge Tinder relied extensively on the Anderson versus Mount Clemens Pottery Company case, the exact case that we rely upon. He quoted it extensively, and he stated that a plaintiff must only show, must only produce sufficient evidence to show the amount and extent of the work as a matter of a just and reasonable inference, which is exactly the argument that we made in our briefs, and it just so happens that Judge Tinder parroted those arguments in a later case.
The Anderson case doesn't include this language, does it? Definite and certain.
No, Your Honor.
Not to be found in that case.
Matter of fact, I went through and did a word search to find out how many times the word definite and how many times the word certain are in there. I believe, if I remember correctly from my brief, the word definite is mentioned once in the Anderson case, and the word certain has a couple more occasions, but there's absolutely no pairing of the two words in the Anderson brief, or in the Anderson opinion.
That language comes out of this Fifth Circuit case, doesn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. It started with the Reeves case, which I believe is a 1980 Fifth Circuit case, and there's been a bit of a prodigy of those cases since that time, primarily in the Fifth Circuit. We did have a Northern District of Indiana case. It starts with a J, and I've never learned how to pronounce it. And then this case would be the only two district court cases in the Seventh Circuit which have ever utilized that standard. The Tenth Circuit in the Riley case specifically rejected the definite and certain standard and cited back to the Supreme Court's case in Anderson. And even the Fifth Circuit itself, in a case that I don't recall off the top of my head, has distinguished and stated in FLSA cases that they weren't going to find that the definite and certain standard review was going to be applicable.
Did Ms. Brown provide any evidence supporting her contention that there were extended holiday hours during the holiday season? In other words, given the contradiction, or the seeming contradiction, let's say, between her deposition and the affidavit, shouldn't she have tried to obtain corroboration from either employees or Family Dollar itself or even customers of the store regarding what seems to me to be an easily verifiable fact?
Well, Your Honor, we didn't do that for summary judgment purposes. However, we didn't realize we had to. I mean, she was testifying as to what those hours were, and to the extent that a trier of fact was going to have to decide that, we were intending to bring corroborating evidence at that time. However,
you were intending to bring
additional evidence to support her assertion at that time. However, you know, as the non-moving party on a motion for summary judgment, her testimony should have been considered at face value, and if she was going to be found incorrect, as you know, she's not telling the truth, that was for a trier of fact at a jury.
Show who changed her hours?
I'm not quite understanding Your Honor's question. I apologize.
Well, she says the records reflect hours that she did not work.
Correct, Your Honor. And she, during her deposition, talked about the ability of the district manager and the assistant district manager to change via computer those records.
All I know is, do the records indicate who changed the hours? Was it her? Was it her district manager? Was it the assistant district manager? Do the records show who made the entries?
Your Honor, there is a document that Family Dollar has produced which shows that Ms. Brown allegedly made the changes. Now, there's a question. I'm sorry.
Is there any evidence in the record that anyone other than Ms. Brown could have made those changes and used her code? In other words, falsified the fact that she made the changes rather than somebody else.
Yes, Your Honor. In her deposition, Ms. Brown stated that she believed that the district and assistant district managers knew her code, or I think it was an employee ID number that was entered.
She thought so?
No, it was simply her belief that they knew her ID code so they could then go into the computer, put in her ID code, and it would look like she had changed her time.
Now, given that she knew how to alter the hours in the computer when the records did not accurately reflect her time, why should we disbelieve the time records that she chose not to alter?
Your Honor, she would not be on notice that the records would be inaccurate until after she had been paid and not paid the correct amount. So at that point in time, her hours would be closed.
No. I, the way I read the briefs, it seemed that she knew how to alter the hours in the computer when she noticed that the records didn't reflect the proper time.
Yes, Your Honor, and
why didn't she alter all the wrong records?
Your Honor, I mean, we're talking about at what point in time did she look at the time or discover that she was not getting paid all the hours that she worked. We're also talking about somebody who had, as from her deposition testimony, this had been her experience since day one with Family Dollar, is that she would put in time and she would not get paid for all her time. And that was her experience when she was simply a cashier, and then she was the assistant manager. And there's discussion in her deposition testimony about talking to Ms. Holder, who was the acting store manager at the time, and then looking at what hours that were on her printout and what hours she was actually being paid, and that there was a discrepancy between the two. She needed the work. She needed the job. She was dealing with the fact that she wasn't getting paid on a weekly basis the amount that she had actually worked. So to a certain extent, Your Honor, you're talking about, you know, why didn't she do this? It was more or less she needed a job and she was working that job. Your Honor, I just to complete my discussion of Judge Tinder's opinion in the Shelton versus Family Dollar case, Judge Tinder noted that the plaintiffs cannot recall how many times they worked overtime and were not properly paid, or how much time they worked off the clock on any given day or week. Their testimony supports a reasonable inference that they did, in fact, work overtime for which they were not properly paid. And in the Shelton versus Family Dollar case, just as we have in this case, we don't have we weren't dealing with employees who could remember exactly, yes, I clocked out at this particular time on this particular date in a year. I mean, in the time period we're talking about here, we're talking about roughly around 2 months for Vivian Brown. She's not able to specifically recall what time she clocked in and what time she clocked out. Rather, she's able to give generalizations as to what time she would arrive in the morning and what time she would leave, given the duties that she was able to do. And, you know, quite frankly, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I just realized I was on.
You can, why don't you finish your thought?
Okay. Quite frankly, we think it's a little bit, it's just simply asking too much of an employee to have that kind of specific information. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Welby. Before you begin, Mr. Wiley, I'm going to give you 2 extra minutes, and Mr. Weldy, I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal as well, all right?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ken.
May it please the Court, my name is Craig Wiley. I represent Family Dollar Stores of Indiana in this appeal. Before I get started on the merits of our appeal, of our position, I'll note that the Shelton case that Mr. Weldy has cited did not appear in the briefs. It was decided after our briefing was ended. Mr. Weldy has not designated the Shelton case before this court to notify the court that this decision was even decided. And pursuant to the Circuit Rule 54, I would ask that Mr. Weldy's notations to the Shelton case either be stricken or we be given an opportunity to brief the Shelton matter as it applies to this case.
The party can have can file within 10 days a memorandum of law not to exceed 5 pages telling us about that case, all right?
Thank you, Your Honor.
The problem I find with this case is that particularly the Anderson's case, which is the leading Supreme Court case on the subject, says that these cases ought to proceed in two phases. First of all, determine the fact of damage, and secondly, determine the extent of damage. It seemed to me that Judge McKinney here said that, well, this plaintiff doesn't know the extent of damages. She can't tell you exactly how much she lost, therefore she loses on summary judgment. And I think that throughout the case there's a confusion between what the extent of the damages is and whether the records were accurate or not, which is the fact of damage. And I'd like to hear your response to that. That seems to me to be the main point of the Anderson case, not this business about definite and certain. To me, that's sort of a red herring. But.
As to the fact of the damage, Miss Brown was at a certain time, excuse me, as of October 19, 2003, she became an assistant manager. She had access to the company's computer database where she could go in and modify her time or another employee's time. From the time that she was a non-exempt employee from that October 19, 2003 until she became a store manager and was exempt on January 9, 2004, she went in and modified her own time 70 times, all to her advantage. Now, one may wonder if she does this, she's going in and modifying 70 times, what's her complaint? why didn't she go in every time that she believes she's been shorted hours? She certainly had that authority and didn't do it. So I think that goes to the fact of damages.
Was that fact litigated? I don't see much talk about that in the briefs.
Yeah, it's in both briefs. It was argued below and it's in the in our brief certainly.
Your theory is that she may not have been awarded the correct amount of hours, but she had an opportunity to correct them, and therefore it shouldn't be held against the employer that incorrect hours were originally recorded. That's
argument? If she received a paycheck stub, as you know, most of us do direct deposit. I think back then Family Dollar did paychecks. Or some did direct deposit as well. But if you go in and you see where you've been shorted hours, unlike just a regular employee, a cashier, she did have the opportunity to go in and make those changes. So if she did it 70 times within...
You're saying a manager can't... the store can't violate the manager's rights under the Fair Labor Standards Act because she has ultimate control over the numbers that are going to be recorded.
No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that if there are mistakes, that she could go in unilaterally and make those changes so that she could correct a mistake. There's no evidence in the record where she... I shouldn't say that. Anything else on that point? As far as the fact of damage and the extent of damage, I can talk to you about what the extent of damage that Judge McKinney, and we pointed out below, is that... and we cited in our appellate brief on pages 17 to 23, is that in her deposition, we went through weeks of time. And we'd say, you know, the week of 11-23 of 2003, do you see anything wrong with your time? You know, and she would say, well, I don't know. I can you tell us whether this time is correct or not? No, I can't. And we go the next week, and that's all.
Was she allowed during that deposition to have records in front of her?
She did. She had all the records she wanted. She had the Family Dollar time card report, which showed the modifications. She had the weekly payroll records, which shows the times that she would clock in and clock out in the amount of time she worked for a week. All those records were in front of her when she was cross-examined.
Now, let me ask you this. Isn't it a reasonable inference that a store such as Family Dollar would indeed have extended holiday hours? I mean, that's a reasonable inference. That's almost common sense, isn't it?
Yeah, well, according to Ms. Brown in her deposition, she said she wasn't sure. She said she recalled that they closed early on Thanksgiving and closed early on Christmas.
When we say holiday hours, that they start those right after Halloween these days, you know. I mean, we're not just talking about the closing on New Year's Eve, the closing on Christmas Eve, or the night before Thanksgiving. And if we thought that she had raised a genuine issue of fact regarding the extended holiday hours, wouldn't that fact alone create a genuine issue of fact regarding the accuracy of the time records that show her clocking out immediately after store hours with no time for any of the closing tasks? And wouldn't that provide a just and reasonable basis for calculating damages? Because a court could assume that a manager has to arrive an hour before opening and leave an hour or two after closing time. I mean, the manager is the person that opens and closes, and you can't just run into the store and scream, we're open, or maybe you can.
Well, to your original point, the holiday hours. This was something that we asked her on direct examination. It wasn't something asked by her counsel. That's why he submitted the affidavit, which contradicted her deposition testimony. But in any event, we did ask her after, you know, the holiday hours. And, you know, she said she wasn't sure whether they had them. But then in her affidavit she submitted after the fact, she said they did have them. But in her deposition before that, we went through every week what she considered holiday hours. It started on November 23rd. You know, do you see anything wrong with the time? You know, for the week of the 23rd?
No,
she couldn't verify whether it was correct or not. We went through all those weeks, and she did not know.
It seems to me that the affidavit doesn't directly contradict the deposition testimony. It seems to me that it supplements it. Am I just wrong? Maybe I am. I mean,
well, as far as her affidavit, she was asked in her deposition. She testified that she did not know what store hours had. She testified that she did not know whether store had different hours during the quote holiday season. Okay. Well, then in paragraphs 4, 5,
well,
and 6...
No, excuse me. When she was asked whether the stores had different hours between Thanksgiving and Christmas, she said it closed early on the holidays. And how does that contradict your affidavit statement that there were extended hours between Thanksgiving and Christmas?
Well, if I'm understanding right, if she says it's closing early on the holidays, wouldn't it be
No. She said that they would close early on Christmas Eve, that they might close early on Christmas Eve or New Year's. She didn't recall the time regarding the day after Thanksgiving. And then she generally said that between Thanksgiving and Christmas, there were extended hours. I'm not seeing the conflict.
Well, I mean, maybe the way I see it, she's playing a little bit fast and loose. You know, you ask her, were there holiday hours? And she comes off and says, well, you know, we got off early. Well, you know.
She's saying we got off early on those two nights, and she doesn't remember Thanksgiving, but she says generally we closed we had later hours during the holiday period. And the holiday period is not just Christmas Eve, New Year's Eve, and the day before Thanksgiving. You know, it's an extended period of time. I mean, that's common sense. I mean, that I think we could almost take judicial notice of holiday hours. Yeah.
As far as Mr. Weldy's discussion of, I believe it was the Riley case. Riley was a Tenth Circuit case. It was unpublished. And what Riley said is that a definite and certain evidence and with just and reasonable inference standard was too onerous on a plaintiff. So they actually doubled it up. Now, what's the difference? We really don't know because a court that I can tell has not defined exactly what definite and certain evidence is or what a just and reasonable inference is. Actually, they have done with definite and certain evidence because in my brief, I cited 11 cases where since Anderson, 11 cases have actually adopted the with definite and certain evidence standard.
They're all in the Fifth Circuit, though, aren't they?
You cited
a whole page full of district courts in the Fifth Circuit.
There's a bunch of district court decisions, but yes, the only appellate decision is out of the Fifth Circuit, and that's the Reeves case. Assuming the court were to get to whether a direct and certain evidence standard applies in these cases, Ms. Brown has waived that argument. It wasn't raised for the first time on a motion to reconsider.
Mr. Wiley, we're going over your time, so if I could ask you to wind up now, please.
Sure. What I was going to say is that it was brought up on the first time on a motion to reconsider, and Judge McKinney disregarded it and, in fact, noted that it was waived for not being raised. But thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wiley. Mr. Weldy?
Thank you, Your Honor, for the additional rebuttal time. Kind of got away from us there. Your Honor, I simply want to point out, and this is pointed out in our brief and the reply brief, that the Riley decision that we cited to actually cites to the Tenth Circuit's 1984 published decision in the Donovan versus United Video Incorporated decision, 725 F. 2nd, 577. So grant that the Riley decision is unpublished, but it does rely upon preceding published precedent within the Tenth Circuit. Your Honor, the only issue that I really want to address is that last issue raised by Family Dollar, the waiver argument. In our opposition brief, we relied upon, and actually in our reply brief, we quoted ourselves, so to speak, discussing the Anderson case, and that was our, you know, that was the standard that we felt should apply, and so that's what we addressed in our opposition. We did not specifically rebut Reeves. At that time, we didn't have any reason to believe that the court, that Judge McKinney would actually cite to a direct and certain evidence standard when we had cited to him the Supreme Court standard that had been followed for so many years. Other than that, Your Honors, that's all we have, unless you have any questions. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. In fact, our thanks to both counsel in the case, Mr. Weldy and Mr. Wiley, and the case will be taken under advisement.